Welcome back to a Country First Conversation. Today we will talk to United States Air Force Major Heather Penny about service, bravery, and heroism. She will share her 9/11 story when she was sent on a suicide mission to protect Washington, D.C. Remember to visit our website, countryfirst.com, and share our podcast with others. Thanks for joining, and here's our host, Congressman Adam Kinzinger.
So joining us today is United States Air Force, retired now, Major Heather Penny. I've been very excited about this one. She was one of two F-16 pilots who flew there on our planes in an attempt to ram and intercept United Airlines Flight 93 before it reached Washington, D.C. During September 11th, 2001. Heather was the only female in her fighter pilot training class and the only female in her fighter squadron at that time with the D.C. Air National Guard. Stationed at Joint Base Andrews. She sure served two tours of duty in the Iraq War. And it's great to have you with us today. I appreciate it. And let me just tell you, I went back about a month and a half ago to Vance Air Force Base, where I went to pilot training. And there are a lot of females and minorities in pilot training now. And that was really exciting to me. You know, different from, I guess, when you got in and you're kind of a trailblazer at that moment. It's good to see a lot of women now, you know, taking on the helm.
Well, Adam, thank you. It's really a privilege to be able to join you here on your podcast. And, you know, exactly what you said, we're seeing so many more women and so much more diversity in pilot training classes. And, you know, it's important to note that really what's driving this is the need to expand the talent pool. It's not about, you know, some kind of a quota and check the block. You know, it's that we have talent in so many different areas. And right now with a pilot shortage, we have to grab the best and the brightest anywhere we can find them. And so now that we're able to really begin to access diversity in order to be able to serve that talent and quality, that's really exciting that we're making it more accessible.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, it's really important because we keep finding ourselves behind the power curve. And, you know, as having just retired out of the Air Force, same thing I do, which is a lot of times they'll say, well, we need to cut pilots. And all of a sudden they're like, oh man, we're so far behind. But what you start to see is people, you know, particularly women and minorities are now starting to realize, you know what, I can go fly. Like, this is an opportunity for me. And it's really awesome to see there's an organization near where I am here in Chicago called Tuskegee Next that basically gives people from, you know, the challenge parts of Chicago a chance to go get their pilot's license. And a lot of these kids are like, wow, I didn't know I could fly these airplanes. So it's really neat.
Exactly. It was never about whether or not they could. It was all about whether or not they knew. Yeah. And as you said, now that we're making that opportunity visible and accessible to them, we're able to really, no kidding now, take the best of the best across, you know, all demographics. And that's only going to improve the quality of the force.
Yeah. And that's, you know, as we look at the challenges in the country, and I'm not even talking about just the political challenges, just the interpersonal challenges, kind of the anger, the division, and, you know, the people that sit on social media all day and just absorb the negative and see the, you know, the life that people put on social media that they quote unquote don't have. And it just creates this animosity. It's, you know, I think the way out of this, and you talk a lot about it. And it's a good transition to, you know, you talk a lot about the importance of belonging, the importance of kind of community and fighting for something bigger than yourself. And so that's where I want to talk a little about heroism. You made a really powerful TED talk and you called it, it's called 9/11 and Everyday Heroism. And it outlines the principles that I've been fighting for, we've been fighting for at the Country First, which is service, bravery, and belonging. Before we jump into that, I want you to tell me a little more about why you joined the Air Force. You know, what is it that drew you to that? And maybe a little about that story of September 11th. How did that come down?
Well, you know, I had wanted to be a fighter pilot ever since I was a young girl. My dad was a fighter pilot. And I just idolized him. I still do to this day. He's absolutely wonderful. And not more than that, I also fell in love with the combination of service, just because when he and his squadron buddies were over at the house where I got to tag along into the fighter squadron, this overwhelming sense of purpose just was so thick. And it really, it was it's hard to describe how that motivated me. But then their brotherhood, how close-knit they were, and frankly, also the adventure. I mean, how could flying jets and flying fast fighter jets just not be cool? I was in love with all of that. I just didn't realize until I showed up to college that fighter pilot or fighters were closed to women. Women at that point were not allowed in any combat positions. And my dad had never bothered to tell me. My mom had always told me I could do whatever I wanted to do. So it was a real surprise. And it wasn't until I was in graduate school that I later learned that Congress had removed the combat exclusion for women and fighters. And so that's...
Congress is always awesome. That's what I try to tell people.
A little pat on the back there. You bet.
That's right.
But that's what made it possible for me and other women to then begin entering the ranks within the fighter community. So that was how I got there.
Well, let me just ask you too, because it's interesting. So you would have been one of the, not the first, but in the very first tranche, basically, of female fighter pilots, right? Was that nerve-wracking or was that invigorating for you?
It was a little bit of both. And so I wasn't in that very first class, right? But I sort of consider myself in the 1.5 wave. And there's a number of women who are where we went straight from pilot training into fighters. The very first woman had actually already earned their wings, but they were flying in non-combat aircraft. And so I was kind of in that 1.5 wave. But there's not that many of us we're seeing a little bit of growth, but not much. But it was challenging because it was really lonely. And, I love my bros. They're fantastic. But it was also a big culture change for all of us to try to navigate and negotiate, what that meant. And ultimately, what I found was if we stayed focused on the mission, and the culture was focused on the mission as well. So I call that a purpose-driven culture or a mission-focused culture, where what you believe, what you value, and how you behave is tied towards mission outcomes. And it's possible for any group to have what I call a culture creep, where they begin to value and act in things that are more about power plays and positioning as opposed to purpose and mission. But ultimately, by just focusing on being a good fighter pilot and the codes, behaviors, beliefs that support those kinds of mission outcomes, that's what, that's really what made it possible and positive.
That's interesting because you talk about the culture side of it, and I'm sure, as a kind of the 1.5 wave of female fighter pilots, right? You're coming into a unit that's like, we can't talk like we used to, right? Or, we have to do things differently.
Yeah, you got to put the porn away, right?
That's right.
More testing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But, that, like I always say, for you guys to have like kind of worked away, and obviously there may be tension, there may not, but the focus on the mission is what matters because, you see so many people, particularly in the Air Force, and I'm sure it's everywhere, that just – they end up kind of losing focus. We call it like the, getting chiefed, as you know that term, I'm sure, where people would go overseas to Al-Udeed or something, and they get more focused on the little things like, is your PT shirt tucked in, than the big broad things like, are we going out and, defending the United States of America? And so when you talk about the culture creep, I'm like, yeah, that's pretty interesting too. So talk about, you get back, you come through pilot training, you go through IFF, you go through FTU, you get to the DC Air National Guard and kind of tell us a little about how 9/11 developed in your day.
Yeah. I was still a pretty green wingman. I had earned my combat mission ready status, earlier that year. And I arrived to my unit in January of 2001. And we had, just gotten back from Red Flag, which is the Air Force's premier go-to-war training exercise, where all different kinds of airplanes from tankers and airlift and bombers and fighters get together. And we fly over the Nellis Ranges, which is just north of Las Vegas. against actual threat systems. So, you know, you've got surface to air radars and emitters. And of course, we're not actually firing any weapons, but it's as close to real combat as we can possibly get. And there's aggressors, so bad guy airplanes and so forth, and you're dropping concrete bombs. And we had just finished getting back from that on Saturday. So the boss gave us, you know, Sunday and Monday off to do our laundry and go grocery shopping and, you know, those things. But as a guard unit, you know, we're mostly part-timers. Mm-hmm. So I was still going through my seasoning days. I still had orders to be at the squadron full-time. And most of our pilots had gone back to their full-time jobs, flying with the airlines, had caught a trip. Many of our full-timers who were there at the squadron every day had taken leave to reconnect with their families and take a little bit of a breather, because we had been pushing it up pretty hard to train for Red Flag. It was really only a skeleton crew in the squadron that morning, and I wasn't scheduled to fly. As a training officer, even though I was a young lieutenant, it was my job to manage the training plan for the squadron. So we were really looking at who was going to fly that week, who was available, who had check rides, and also looking at the long-term schedule for September as well.
And by the way, a training officer is a terrible job, just so everybody knows. It's a lot of paperwork.
You know, someone's got to do it. And mm-hmm. you're right, there was a lot of paperwork. That's why I wasn't flying that day.
That's right.
But we were, you know, as a guard unit, we have two chains of command. We've got the federal chain of command, which happens when we get activated to go overseas, at the time Northern Watch or Southern Watch, or civilian chain of command. And in most guard units, that their commander in chief on the civilian side is their governor, who activates them for, you know, fires, floods, and famine, you know, things like that. We've got a lot of units activated out west right now for the forest fires or doing ISR after hurricanes, sandbags, and so forth. But the DC Guard's civil chain of command goes up to the president. So, which he normally delegates that authority now to the Secretary of the Army. So we were in a civilian status that morning, and we were just kind of getting back to a low-key day-to-day operation, reconfigure the aircraft. We had sent a three-ship, so three fighters down to Air Force Adair to Cape Hatteras to do some just real basic bombing operations. So it was just going to be kind of a low key day for us when I'm sitting in the scheduling meeting with our director of operations, Mark Sasseville, and our weapons officer, Dan Kane, our scheduling officer, Mark Valentine, when one of our enlisted troops, David Chunks Callahan, he knocks on the door and he just opens it up and says, an aircraft hit the World Trade Center. Mm. And we didn't think of really anything of it. We probably made a few inappropriate jokes because we just thought it was probably a light Cessna that was doing
some sightseeing. I thought the same thing. Like what, you know, man, how do you accidentally hit a building, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and all across the East Coast, it was just a spectacularly blue day. Mm-hmm. So we were just, you know, kind of made a couple jokes. We didn't take it seriously because small aircraft bounce off of buildings, you know, right. It's just not that big of a deal. And it wasn't until he came back and said a second aircraft hit the second World Trade Center and it was on purpose. Mm. That's when we got up and then went to the bar, saw the television, saw those images that everyone else saw. And that's when we realized our nation was under attack.
Ah, it's incredible. So, you know, and I, for me, it's kind of bittersweet. I remember that day as a day that America, you know, came together. We joined together in a mission and, you know, today watching. You know, as we record this, kind of the first news of the attack at the Kabul airport, and we know about the evacuation, the end of the mission there. And it's, you know, on the one hand, you look at the lives we've changed. On the other hand, you look and you say, man, it feels like we just kind of chose to lose this moment. But, you know, without getting too into that, what's kind of your thoughts on, you know, what is that? So I guess finish your story on that in terms of the, you know, the call out you got, the mission, and then kind of how that feels today a little bit, putting it all together as you see this kind of mission in Afghanistan wrapping up.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it because of those organizational challenges I told you about, we're a guard unit. We don't, you know, we're not actually connected to a governor. We don't have an alert mission because of how the nation slashed the Air Force in half mm-hmm. after the fall of the Soviet Union. I mean, so there were all of these things that prevented us from being able to get airborne. And we also just didn't have any live weapons on board either, because we don't fly around. Nobody flies around in training with live explosive weapons. I don't think the American public would appreciate it if we did, but it's also, it's also about preserving those capabilities and so forth. So we had to get armed and we had to get the authorization to launch. Our squadron leadership leaned forward and took the risk of building up AIM-9 weapons without the authorization, without orders. Because, I mean, you know, Adam, in the military, we're the world's largest bureaucracy. We don't do anything without a paper trail, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So our director of operations, Mark Sasseville, and Dan Kane, our weapons officer, together, they made the decision to order our bomb dump to begin building up missiles. And they could do that because they could manage that risk, right? They could control how far that went, but we could not, without authorization from our nation's leadership, we could not launch, because of potential consequences. If we were to find an airliner, we didn't have the chain of command, the command and control, to be able to take decisive action, given the potential consequences on those civilians, on that airliner, and on the people on the ground. So we had to wait. And unfortunately, it took the Pentagon getting hit before Vice President Cheney said, aren't there fighters at Andrews? Somebody get them airborne. Yeah. I mean, we weren't sitting around. Our wing commander, David Worley, was trying to go up our traditional chain of command through the guard. So he was trying to find somebody who had the authority to let us launch. And Mark Sasseville was trying to reach the Secret Service, because if he could reach the Secret Service, maybe he could get to the president or national leadership, find someone there in that roundabout way to be able to provide us that authorization as well. So we were still leaning forward to try to get airborne. But it was too late.
Ah, man.
When we go ahead.
No, please.
When Cheney finally gave us the authorization to launch, we still did not have AIM-9s on board. So we did not have live weapons. And while we were waiting, Sass and Raisin took myself and the other wingmen, Brandon Igor Rasmussen, and to Weaponeer, and trying to figure out, okay, so what's our game plan going to be? Because this is not something we had tactics for. It's not something that we were trained for, right? So we went through and took our best analogs of how our weapons work and what we had figured out for bad guy airplanes, and tried to Weaponeer, how would we possibly take down an airliner? And we had to think about all contingencies, which included, what if we did not get missiles in time? And that was when we realized that, we were loaded out with 105 rounds each of training bullets, which are, they're basically like 20 millimeter BB guns. They're just lead. It's not like the high explosive incendiary rounds that we take to combat. And we knew that a two ship would not have sufficient firepower to take down an airliner. And that's when we realized that if any of us took off unarmed, that this would be a suicide mission. And then we thought about, well, where's the most lethal place to ram our aircraft? And Sass would take the cockpit and I would take the empennage, the tail section of the aircraft.
Oh my goodness. I couldn't imagine going through that. I mean, obviously 9/11 was such a day, but in a very short order, you guys went from this thing's not real to, you're going to take the cockpit, I'm going to take the tail section. And, that's a whole new layer of kind of things you wake up never expecting to ever have to say or see or hear or think.
Yeah, that's true. But I just have to commend the leadership of the squadron at the time. Again, I was just a young wingman. I was a brand new lieutenant, right? But to have the leadership of Sass and Raisin, Mark Drifter Valentine, our weapons or our intelligence officer at the time, David Nuts McNulty, started putting together at the time open source intelligence. You know, this is before we had internet. He's literally calling airline reservation desks and calling the air traffic control radar center to try and build up an air order battle to try and, you know where all the airliners are, where they've been landed, what flights are inbound and outbound and so forth. But what was amazing was that although it was just sort of surreal, SAS, Raisin, Drifter, the leadership there in the squadron, they didn't stay in any kind of state of disbelief. Mm-hmm. They immediately accepted the unthinkable as this is a situation we're in. They understood properly that our nation was under attack, and they immediately began to plan an action on what we needed to do to fulfill our mission to protect and defend the nation's capital. So, you know, like you know, any airline pilot, any fighter pilot, any military pilot, any civilian pilot, you know that when you have an emergency situation, there's that split second of disbelief, like, well, this can't be happening because mm-hmm. this isn't normal and how it's supposed to go. But you have to move past that disbelief to actually take the data, take the facts, analyze the situation so you can understand it properly and then take the appropriate action. And that's exactly what they did. And if they had not, although SAS and I ended up being a mission failure, we got there too late. The passengers on Flight 93 had to take action and take that airliner down. I mean, they truly are the heroes of this story. But we would not even have been in that position had the leadership there, SAS, Raisin, Drifter, had they not realized what needed to be done and moved immediately into action.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that. So I talk a lot when I talk to different groups about what is leadership. And I always say, you know, I can give you a definition, the Air Force will give you a definition. The truth is, you know, is it somebody you would willingly follow into hell, right? Is that a leader? And it's hard to really put too, you know, you can put some adjectives on it. You can put some ideas on it. But that's one of the things I've noticed in my military career is the people that I would follow, you know, into those kinds of situations are the ones that are willing to do what your squadron leadership did, which is like, look, we are, everything's on fire. We have a helmet fire. Everything's burning down, but let's stop. Let's think this through. Let's accept the reality. It's like that, you know, and they teach us in pilot training, maintain aircraft control, analyze the situation, take appropriate action, land as soon as conditions permit. And you see that in people's leadership skills. But one of the things I want to say is you talk about your mission as a failed mission. You said that, you know, in your TED talk particularly, and you talked about the passengers of United 93. I think you said, particularly, heroism is not something unique or possessed by only a chosen few. That these passengers were just like you and me, and we all have that totally ordinary, everyday hero inside of us. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean? Because I thought that was one of the more powerful things I had heard.
You know, it has been in the decades that have passed that I've really begun to realize that. In all of our mythologies and so forth, it's almost like Hollywood heroes, that a hero is somebody that's born with these unusual characteristics. But the truth of the matter is we all have that capacity inside of us. And it's the actions of the passengers on 93 that made me really realize that heroism is something ordinary. And as Americans, it's part of our DNA. I mean, we talk about the greatest generation of our grandfathers being heroes and our grandmothers being heroes because they mobilized during World War II, every single one of them, right? From your librarian to the boy at the soda shop counter to the local car repairman to save the free world. But the thing is, there was nothing unique about them. They were all just utterly ordinary, but they rose to the occasion. And that's something that we shouldn't have to depend on a crisis or a global war to allow that heroism to come up to the top, to be part of our daily lives. I mean, we can actually make choices in how we live and how we behave and what we value in order to cultivate that kind of everyday heroism. Because when those passengers, you know, took their tickets and boarded Flight 93 that morning, they were just doing their ordinary lives. They were going on a business trip or coming home from seeing grandma or going on vacation. They didn't wake up that morning and say, you know what, today's the day I'm going to be a hero. But they answered the call. We shouldn't have to wait for that kind of crisis to find out what we're made of. And I worry that if we do, if we're complacent or passive like that, we might find that maybe our capacity for that kind of heroism might not necessarily be as strong as needed. So if there are choices that we can make every day, and I have distilled them down to bravery and service and belonging, that those are things that we can consciously and deliberately do and act upon to cultivate the attributes of heroism.
You know, it's interesting because when you talk about belonging, you know, it really triggered a thought in me, which is everybody needs to belong to something. And I think part of the concern we have out there is that, you know, people feel more isolated than ever. Obviously, COVID, when you're locked in, you felt isolated. They find community online, you know, and I started to think a little about, like, okay, if your primary identity is your, I don't know, let's say it's your political affiliation, that becomes your primary identity, and everything else, like your the biggest group you belong to, the thing you're most proud of is your political identity. That becomes the thing that you belong to and the thing that you will act in theory heroically for. But if you think about yourself as an American, which I think that's part of what's missing, is we think of ourselves in tribalistic terms now and not as Americans. If you think of yourself as American, you'd be willing to act for your fellow man. That's doesn't matter if they're Republican, Democrat, anything else. It's just that doesn't even cross your mind when you're thinking about acting on on behalf of somebody or on behalf of a mission, if you will.
I wholeheartedly agree, Adam. You know, and as you mentioned, part of this isolation and the division that's been going on for decades, but really has come to the forefront over the past couple of years, it has trapped us inside of our own little algorithms and our own echo chambers. And one of the things that I think was so valuable about sort of the before times, and even before COVID, but really before we began to see the greater divisions that resulted from our online affiliations, was that you had to interact with people and Americans that are different than you. Mm-hmm. And you had to do so in a civil way because it was face to face. Our communities are have so much diversity and so much differences in them that, you know, even though you might on the outside all look the same, but your experiences, where you came from, you know, and just even when it comes down to people's individual little quirks, were so different, and we had to engage civilly with them. Over time, that creates a sense of bond and community and belonging. So as you said, you know, that as we've grown more and more isolated, we become, I think, less and less connected to what it means to be part of this bigger project, this bigger ideal that is America.
Yeah, and that's my biggest concern in all of this, and why I thought, you know, so obviously I've been paying attention to you and your story since it became public after 9/11, and I think, you know, as you and I got reconnected and I've seen what you've been talking about, it's like that's the kind of thing that in a time where everybody feels mired down, I think it's important to remember that, you know, we are all Americans. We all are in this together. You know, you look at, for instance, you talk about heroes and you see these, you know, a mom and a dad in Afghanistan struggling through a big crowd, which now has had suicide bombings in it, to get their child to freedom and to safety, and the people that have worked with our troops. And of course, our Marines that are there right now, you know, protecting these evacuees. And a hero doesn't have to be somebody that carries a gun or runs into a fire. A hero is just somebody that chooses every day to live for something bigger than themselves. And I think that is how we are going to revolutionize this kind of amazing time we really live in. I mean, that's the thing, is we forget how amazing right now is, you know?
Yeah.
But we always keep miring ourselves down in the negative.
Well, you know, and I'll add something to what you were saying about, you know, a hero is someone who chooses to live and act in service of something that's bigger than themselves, is that we also must ensure that what we are doing is not based in fear.
That's right.
And that's what I've seen. So much of the anger and the vitriol is fundamentally fear-based. And so people are taking action in their subgroups and they're saying things and they're doing things that are full of anger and full of hate that, again, are motivated by fear. And no hero can come from that. No heroism can result from fear. Mm-hmm. If it's fear-based, because that really ultimately is about hurting others, striking out at others. And it's really a destructive force. So we have to be able to rise above the fear in order to really connect. And I think that that's an important piece of what you were getting at regarding how do we heal as America? How do we come back together as Americans? Because as you said, this is a phenomenal point in our history, a great opportunity for a nation to really transform itself even closer to the ideals that we're built upon as a nation. But we have to rise above that fear.
Yeah. And, you know, you think about on that day, 9/11, had you thought through every bad thing that could happen? Had your squadron leadership thought through every possibility and worried that maybe if they went too far and getting the AIM-9s together, if they launched and, you know, maybe I'm going to get busted down a rank, maybe I'm going to get kicked out. You would have let fear swallow you up, and your squadron and you would not have launched a single plane on 9/11. And you think about, you know, Todd Beamer and the others on the airplane. If Todd Beamer had stood up and said, let's roll, and nobody joined him, or if he'd have sat in his chair and said, you know, I know what the news is saying, but there's a decent chance these people will still land the plane. It very easily could have hit the Capitol. And fear, it's, you know, having fear is normal. You can't pretend like there is no fear.
It's human.
It's human. That's right. It's actually the most basic instinct we really have. It's like fear and then heights are like the two things that Americans are afraid of, or people are afraid of. But overcoming that to action is what the definition of, you know, being able to stand for something bigger stuff. And I'll tell you, you know, having been a military guy myself, and you having, you know, finally retired after 20 years of service, there is nothing that I am going to be more proud of in my life, of course, besides getting married, you know, than my time, my wings, my time in the Air Force, and my time being willing to fight for something bigger than myself. And I know you feel the same way. So Heather, let me just say, as we wrap up, again, having watched you for 20 years, since basically you were identified publicly as the person that had launched on 9/11, and then watching where you're going, and also seeing all the cool airplanes you fly now, it's great to be a friend with you. And I would encourage everybody, by the way, to go and find that TED Talk. Just type in Heather Penny on YouTube. And did you actually give that at Scott Air Force Base? Is that where that was?
No, that was up in New York, actually. So okay. It was really meaningful to be able to share that message with New Yorkers.
Yeah, it's really incredible. And I could tell that, you know, it seems like that day and that idea still affects you almost the same as it did then. Like you've almost gotten a deeper understanding of what that day meant to the country and to you.
That's true.
Well, Heather, thanks for joining us. And to everybody, thank you for listening again to Country First Conversations, and we'll catch you next time.
This has been a Country First Conversation with Adam Kinzinger and United States Air Force Major Heather Penny. Thank you for joining today, and be sure to check out Major Penny's TED Talk online as well. The Country First team wants to hear from you. Please be sure to share in the comments or send us a note at info@countryfirst.com to share your thoughts. And be sure to visit countryfirst.com for other podcast conversations. And be sure to subscribe to receive all the latest updates. We'll catch you next time as we continue to put country over party.